This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Edmund Chinookabark, and I'm delighted to say that I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to this, the first ACAM webinar that's been organised to mark the publication of this year's annual research review. And I'm especially delighted that people are joining us from so many different countries. I hear there are 24 different countries represented in the delegates to this webinar. At the JCP, of course, our mission is to publish the very best research in child and adolescent psychiatry, keeping a methodologically broad focus and a multidisciplinary perspective, with the ultimate goal, of course, of promoting science-driven and evidence-based practice. The publication of the annual research review is a key part of that mission, much anticipated each year by people in the field, and not least by the editors themselves. It brings together preeminent researchers at the top of their game to present broad-based and authoritative reviews on key topics. Now, the annual research review has been going on a long time at the JCP, and every year it seems to me it gets better and better. Over the last few years, a lot of this has been due to the work of Professor Pasco Fearon, who's been the annual research review editor. And I have to say that one of the most wonderful things about being the JCPP editor-in-chief is the chance to work with such brilliant editors who work tirelessly to produce the papers that have had such an impact on the field. So I'm going to hand over to Pasco, who's going to chair today's session. But before I do, just say, I'd like to thank him publicly for the great work he's done this year. So over to you, Pasco.
Thanks, Edmund. Yeah, so welcome, everybody. This is a really great moment for me, actually, because this is this is the point after about, 18 months of working with some of these guys and all the other authors on the special issue for, you know, for at least a year, if not 18 months, hard work, and but also, you know, an absolute delight for me to do. And this is the point where it's all done, the hard work has been completed, and we have a chance together here today, but also with you online, to reflect on what the annual research review is telling us about the very vibrant field of child psychology and psychiatry and developmental psychopathology. And I must say that, you know, every year it's a real pleasure for me just to sort of look at what we've achieved in the different reviews. And I think one of the things that comes across so clearly is just how dynamic and exciting the whole field is becoming and has been for many years. This particular issue, we don't plan it actually in this way particularly to have a theme, but actually usually it turns out that probably subconsciously somewhere there is a theme that was brewing in my mind as I started to think about who I would invite to do some of these papers. And in this particular issue, you'll see there's a really wide range of topics that we cover, from epigenetics to the neurobiology and physiology of stress, to prenatal and neonatal brain imaging, to research on the developmental impacts of bullying and of interparental conflict and domestic violence, to novel treatments for neurodevelopmental disorder, particularly autism, and to interventions for suicide. So it's this incredibly broad array of rich papers. But as I mentioned in my editorial, what comes across to me is that the common thread joining all of these different papers is an interest in pushing the boundaries, the envelope of what science can tell us about the mechanisms and processes by which the environment impacts on development and on risk for psychopathology. And so that's very much the theme of today's discussion. I'll be encouraging our authors, those that are here today, to reflect on what their papers say about where, what do we now understand about the environment, how can we study it, how can we use those insights to advance better, more effective clinical intervention. So that's hopefully what we're going to be talking about today. Matt, at the beginning of the session, talked about that we're very keen to get your questions. So I will be the chair. On this iPad here, I will receive your questions and I'll be putting it to my colleagues here. So please do send in your questions. That's going to make it much more fun if we have questions from you. So I'll be looking closely on my iPad to see what you've got to ask our questions to our panellists. And on that note, without further ado, I would introduce our first speaker, let's say, which is Professor Gordon Harold, whose paper in the Annual Research Review was a fantastic, wide-ranging scholarly review of what we know about the current state of play on research relating domestic violence to child outcomes and development. So, Gordon, can you start us off with a succinct summary of your work, and then we'll get the conversation.
I can't guarantee it'll be succinct, Pascoe, but I'll do my
very best. I'll try to help you.
So first to say thank you to Pascoe and to Edmund for their expert work in pulling this together. It's easy to summarise papers. The process that they have respectively facilitated with the reviewers has been exceptional, and the papers are a product of that as much as anything else, so thank you both. So our paper, my paper with Dr. Ruth Sellers at the University of Sussex, the focus of the special, of the annual review, I should say, has the word environment as a centrepiece, returning or revisiting the relevance of the environment, the children's mental health and development. And I'm happy to say that I'm, or unhappy to say that I'm, around long enough in terms of academic research that the term environment really has swung from old-fashioned nurture into nature, to nature via nurture, to nature times nurture, etc. So our paper really revisits a classic indicator or factor with respect to children's mental health and development, which is the intraparental relationship. Intraparental relationship nested within the family environment as a key influence on children's normal and atypical development. Historically, the intraparental relationship received attention over several decades, but the intraparental relationship, i.e. dynamic between historically two biologically related parents, two adults, has been located within the realms of domestic abuse, domestic violence, or divorce-focused, parental separation, divorce-focused research. And our research illuminates, if you like, the importance of those established traditions in terms of intraparental relationship influences on children, but really brings a focus to the nature of that relationship. That is, if you like, is qualitative. So whether or not parents are living together, married or not married, and as we explain, whether parents or rearing parents are genetically related or not, we bring research attention to, or attention to, aspects of the intraparental relationship whereby behaviours that are negative, ranging from what we call the silence to violence continuum, which may be new to some people. What do I mean by silence? Well, where adults are engaged in a non-volatile, non-violent relationship, but nonetheless where they don't engage terribly positively with each other, low levels of warmth, where partners treat each other with silent treatment in the context of conflicted exchanges in their relationship. Very important to say at the outset that intraparental conflict, people regularly ask me, oh my goodness me, we should never quarrel in front of our children. And I say, well, actually, most couples quarrel in front of their children, and most children do fine. It's where children experience conflicts between their parents or carers that are measured as frequent, intense, and poorly resolved that children do less well. How are children affected by the silence to violence continuum? Well, new research shows very clearly that early brain development is affected using fMRI techniques, physiological arousal, early heart rate, cortisol processes, anxiety, depression, conduct problems, academic attainment, future relationship challenges, self-harm, suicidality, and very recent evidence, longitudinal evidence, showing intergenerational transmission processes. So where children experience acrimony between parents, again, from low level to high level, they tend to replicate across generations. In terms of mechanisms, there are two main mechanisms that I want to bring attention to. Classically, a mechanism is intraparental discord is associated with poor outcomes for children via parenting. More recent research has expanded the term parenting to show subtle differences between how mothers and children interact and how fathers and children interact, and how the co-parenting relationship as a product of both is affected by those interactions. But evidence shows very clearly now that where you control for supportive parenting or you focus in on parenting, but where there are high levels of intraparental discord and volatility between adults and you don't focus in on that relationship by way of support, you see limited returns long-term for children and continued effects of the interparental relationship on children's outcomes. A big challenge, so processes and mechanisms. So there are multiple mechanisms within family mechanisms, parenting, within child mechanisms, neurobiology, psychophysiology, and other processes within children directly that explain these environmental effects on outcomes. One of the big challenges in terms of mechanism, I was asked a question in the turn of the century, millennium, in the year 2000, where in presenting findings at a conference, a colleague said, it's all very interesting, Gordon, that you make the case that domestic abuse, domestic violence, harsh parenting practices, etc., are linked to poor outcomes for children. But the vast majority of studies that illuminate these processes tend to involve biologically related parents and children. And on that basis, you can't actually dismantle a potentially key mechanism, which is the role of common genes. So in other words, in biologically related samples, rearing parents and children share genes. So how can we dismantle or uncouple, if you like, the role of biology, underlying biology, and the associations with the children? So there's two main types of confound, if you like, in terms of traditional studies. One is what's called passive gene environment correlation, quite simply the association between an index of rearing environment, instrumental parenting, and child outcome is explained by shared genes. The second is what's called evocative gene-environment correlation. There's other active gene-environment, etc. Evocative gene-environment correlation, whereby genetic attributes in the child evoke the rearing experiences that they are subjected to. Both have substantive implications for intervention. And really, as a person who was trained in the socialization literature when I was trained in the United States, Iowa State University, Rand Conger, and I thank Rand for his efforts. If I used the word genes in my research group and I wasn't referring to denim, I was asked to go off and stand in a corner. So I had to go off and become a scholar of quantitative behavioral genetics in order to try and take on that question. And I thank my colleague Anita Thapper, Leslie Lev, other colleagues for giving me the time and patience to do that. So I went away, had the good fortune to work with two very novel research designs, one called the Early Growth and Development Study, which I know, Pascoe, you're also involved with. And a study that my colleague Anita Thapper and I established at Cardiff involving a sample of approaching 1,000 children who were conceived through assisted reproductive technology, specifically IVF. With each of these samples, we can look at associations between aspects of the family environment, parenting, interparental, and outcomes for children, where children are not genetically related to their rearing parents. Importantly, in the US adoption sample, the EGAD sample, children have been adopted at birth, which also addresses a major confound in adoption context, which is lag time to placement. Over the past 10 years, we've addressed the question, might the associations be explained by common genes, to probably not. Very important to say that that does not mean that genetic factors are not highly important for in explaining variation in outcomes for children. And actually, by working with sophisticated research designs that can isolate out common genes, common genetic effects, we can look more precisely at things like gene-environment interaction, epigenetic processes, etc. So we've arrived at a place that the annual research review really summarizes, which is, guess what? Rearing environments that children experience affects their outcomes. The intraparental parent-child relationships both matter. From a policy standpoint, our research has influenced major investments in the UK. Department for Work and Pensions currently investing £40 million targeting intraparental relationship support relative to parenting support and outcomes for children. Bottom line, how parents relate to each other, carers relate to each other, matters across family types, adoption, foster care, step-parent families, single-parent families, traditional nuclear parent families, and what children experience in one generation maps on to the next generation.
Fantastic. Thanks, Gordon. That's an incredibly lucid summary of your paper. I'm thinking that maybe what might be an idea is if you chaps ask a question while I review what questions are coming in, and then I can catch up with you.
Yeah, I was thinking when I was rereading your paper for this webinar, Gordon, I was thinking there's nothing on measurement there, and because I can imagine a lot of the delegates thinking when people report interparental conflict, I'd have really been honest, because I think I would find it hard, you know, to talk about those very private things. Is there an issue around measurement?
Well, one of the sections in the paper is actually specifically titled Measurement. And it's how do we introduce inquiry to adults that taps into the reality of what happens at home rather than when we're sitting in front of a questionnaire. We've suggested an array of measures that show psychometric robustness, if you like, and also a criterion and construct-related validity. So a number of studies in the US using observational methods, which then employ self-report approaches. and we show strong correlations between both methods. Also, in terms of predicting those children who evidence difficulties, certain questionnaires are more accurate than others. Mm. It's quite interesting, when you ask couples or adults to ask about aspects of their relationship, you're quite right, they might appear hesitant. However, when you introduce the salience of that relationship for children's mental health and outcome, in the same way that you can ask about parenting, you tend to encourage parents to respond in terms of accuracy and validity. It's a good question. But yeah, we deliberately put a section into the paper to try to address that particular point, and primarily to direct it, advice towards practitioners who want, in terms of frontline interests, how do you ask these questions in a valid and robust manner?
Mm. So, can I ask? Yeah. So, Gordon, I'm, you know, you've come out with an important, as it were, underlining of things I think people will be sort of familiar with conceptually. I'm interested from the child's point of view. What's the mechanism, do you think, of effect? In other words, if you're a child in a family where there is major discord, what is it that is impacting on you as a child that is going to feed through into mental health, well-being difficulties? Yeah. Because obviously underlying that is that that is the key place where the effect is going to happen and maybe where treatments need to be targeted. So what is it about the family environment that, how's it affecting the
child? That's a very good question, Jonathan. I think, again, in our paper, we review several mechanisms. So we can talk about complex neurobiological processes, so early brain development, psychophysiological processes, again, markers of stress reactivity, right the way through to attributional processes. And it's quite interesting, the attributional domain, in other words, how does the child interpret what's happening around him or her, really does appear to be a mechanism of cascading significance. So how one attributes experiences, of course, derives from neurobiological development and psychophysiological exposure, but actually the thought processes that go with experiences. So I didn't go into my in detail in my review, but in the paper, there's a strong literature around children's specific attributions. So where parents are engaged in frequent, intense, and poorly resolved conflicts, but where children ascribe self-blaming attributions, it's my fault, my parents usually quarrel about me, my parents quarrel about things that I do, I can't do things to make myself feel better when my parents quarrel, threat, not just to them, but in terms of family stability. So where children understand that they are the source cause and are responsible for conflicts, they do less well, and they're much more likely to perpetuate conflicts in their own relationships.
Mm. So if people are arguing about money, for instance, less likely to impact on the kids than arguing about the kids.
Well, if they're arguing about the money frequently, intensely, and not resolving terribly successfully, it doesn't help children particularly. An important point, however, is where children can understand why the parents are quarrelling, they do better. Mm. So actually, in terms of intervention programmes, helping parents understand the management of conflicts and communicating the underlying causes of the conflicts, children do better. So yes, in that respect. Mm.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that the key intervening mechanism is really about what the child makes and what is happening between the parents.
Yeah. Mm. And but also from intervention, helping parents understand that children are astute observers of behaviour.
Yeah.
So parents will regularly say, we don't quarrel in front of our children.
Yeah, they don't know.
But the children can pick up detailed signals.
Top of the stack.
Absolutely, or in the car, for example. Yeah. They go out, you know, and people can pick up a change in behaviour. Our children can pick up a change in behaviour.
Yeah.
So you're quite right. It's helping, it's recognising children in terms of mechanisms they're in, but really informing parents that subtle aspects of change in behaviour are significant for children.
So I have one question, which is this, that there's some research that shows for relationships high in conflict, if the mother and father divorce, the children tend to fare better in the long run. Would it be an absence of negative exposure? Would there necessarily have to be something positive added to the relationship?
It's a good question. Certainly the intervention studies in the separation divorce context show that the reduction of ongoing chronic stress marked by interparental conflict, children do better. So the removal of conflict is indeed a positive.
Is it positive?
Is a positive, yeah.
Before we move on, I've got some questions from our audience. Thank you very much for those. So the first is from Rachel Wood from A Better Start in Southend. So thanks, Rachel. The question is, have there been any steps forward in the development of evidence-based support and prevention services in terms of domestic abuse for parents and their children in the early years, in the 0-4 years? You review some of that literature, I think.
Review that, and that's in one of the tables. We provide a summative table and a more developed table. So I would refer the person asking the question to those tables. The answer is yes. I mean, the growth in this area is significant. most intervention programs, again focusing on family processes, on child outcome, would be very parenting, and particularly mother-child parenting directed, and programs targeting interparental relationship attributes, both in within from intact separation, divorce, and domestic violence contexts, is really a growth area. And we review those recent programs and evidence-based programs. Very important to say that programs we review are evidence-based programs. So programs people may have heard of, be aware of, have not made it into our review with respect to the evidence that is presented.
And would you say that on the basis of the review that you did, that you would feel quite positive about what can be achieved with these sorts of early interventions?
Absolutely. And I think the real compliment, I guess, in terms of where things are, and we use the UK government policy example as example, is that UK government is putting money now where evidence mouths are, and investing in programs that show evidence-based promise with respect to implementing and evaluating here in the UK. So things have never been better, certainly in this area in the UK.
Yeah. Great, thank you. I hope that answers your question. Should, I imagine, be very helpful with the sort of work you're doing, a better start. Second question, this is a more technical one, which is you mentioned that heart rate changing as a result of silence to violence spectrum in the parental relationship, the child's heart rate, that is this a lasting change, and is it up or down? As low resting heart rate has been linked to aggressive and criminal externalising behaviour, could there be a link there? This was somebody posting anonymously. By the way, so I don't have the name.
Yeah, so the research that we cite actually specifically is an experimental study involving six-month-old children, where children are exposed to audible, recorded, controlled exchanges between their actual parents and unfamiliar, unrelated adults. And they show a significant difference in marked heart rate increase to their parents versus the unfamiliar adults. So really the study shows that, you know, children as young as 6 months can pick up by way of their environment.
So it's a transient change.
It's a transient change.
But it's, I suppose it's experimentally showing that if that was sustained, then that
quite right. And of course, heart rate being an index on elevated cortisol activity, vagal tone, and other markers of psychophysiological arousal. Mm.
But it's in pre-verbal children?
Yes, pre-verbal children.
Yeah, very interesting. Great, thank you very much. So we need to move on. Thanks very much for that, Gordon. So our next summariser of his fantastic paper in the Annual Research Review is Jonathan Green from the University of Manchester. So again, Jonathan, do you want to give us a summary of the paper, and then we can have a nice discussion about it?
Yeah, thank you. So, Pascal, when you invited me to do this, I reflected initially on how fragmented the review literature on autism treatment is actually around the world. There are many reviews that come out, often seeming to come to rather different conclusions, presumably from different starting points or different thought processes. And that's an interesting thing in itself, often quite polarized views across the world about autism treatment. It's quite a contested area. So I decided with my co-author, Dr. Shruti Garg, we're both in Manchester, to try and address this in two ways, really. One was to try and take quite a rigorous methods quality approach, to try and see, can we sort out the wheat from the chaff in terms of actually the methodological quality of these trials and review papers. And the second thing was to take a mechanism approach, which is to say, could we find a handle on what was really happening in autism treatment through looking at the actual targets of implicit or explicit targets, because people often aren't always clear about their targets of treatment. Could we evaluate those targets and really see if we could think across the different targets as to what progress has actually been made or not, and whether some of it's a bit illusory, because a lot of claims are made in autism treatment research. So we've done that in this paper, and we also took the opportunity to do something that I don't think has been done before, which is to combine together what one might call psychosocial treatment targets, that is the behavioral social communication type intervention targets, which are commonly thought of as autism interventions, with the more perhaps more recent neurological brain mechanism targets that are increasingly important in the field. And so we've tried to use the mechanism approach to really take a view across those two, both the psychosocial and the brain environment, if you like, and to look in terms of methods quality. So what have we come up with? Well, we made use of a companion piece in your annual research review compendium this year by French and Kennedy, which is a systematic review of recent autism psychosocial treatment research. So they didn't actually tackle the more neural mechanisms that we've been talking about in our paper. But nevertheless, it gave a good foundation for us. And so we are grateful to them for that work. We built on that, and we wanted to look at the methods quality. And the first thing to say is that the methods quality across the board is not brilliant. That many intervention research papers are produced in autism treatment, often of very small samples, underpowered to get reliable effects. And the main thing about methods, it's not really a geeky sort of methods preoccupation. It's basically saying how trustworthy is the information that one gets out of it. That's the sort of key thing. How free of bias might it be? Nothing's completely free of bias, but how free of bias might it be? So what French and Kennedy found was that only a minority, 6 out of the 48 papers that they included in their review, actually had a reasonable methods quality. So that's really quite a minority when you think of the field. So that's unfortunate. You know, it suggests that the trials community in autism really needs to up its game if we're going to produce a body of reliable work. The second thing that we can infer from that is that a lot of treatments in common usage actually have no evidence base at all. And that's often a surprise to people because it is an area where a lot of claims are made. And so we try and be quite explicit about that in the paper. For instance, a lot of the behavioural treatments, such as so-called ABA and EIBI, which are commonly, probably the most common treatments for autism promoted across the world, have really very, very sparse evidence base and nothing that actually comes up to the standards that that French and Kennedy used and that we used in our review. Now, that may be a surprise to some people, but it's the case. And it's an important thing in such a important condition as autism, which has so many developmental implications, etc. So many treatments in common use don't have a good evidence base. Okay, so what have we found does have a reasonable evidence base? And when we looked at the psychological treatments from a mechanistic point of view, what we wanted to do is to separate out a number of different components here. One was that a lot of treatments look to intervene in children's most intimate social relationships. So obviously autism is an impairment of social function and social development. And so people look at some of the most what we could call proximal, that's closest to the intervention context, which would be, for instance, a child interacting with their parents socially. And we asked how many interventions look at that and what effect have they got. We then looked to see, okay, so do we get a change that then generalizes out beyond that parent-child interaction into the child's everyday life? Because if it doesn't do that, then we would be it would be wrong to say we had a really good treatment for autism. Autism is a pervasive developmental disorder that affects all aspects of the child's life. It's not much point just changing a very small thing, which is very related to the treatment context, if you're not really generalizing any effect beyond that. So we looked at that. And then the third aspect we looked at was the developmental aspect, which is that autism is par excellence a neurodevelopmental disorder. It's enduring through development. And if we're going to have interventions that we can evaluate as successful, really we need to show that they are working over time, that their effect is sustained through development over time. And when you look at it like that, quite an interesting picture emerges. So the vast majority of treatments that claim to be treatments for autism and often claim to be effective are really showing effect just on that most proximal piece of either parent interaction with their child, which actually has nothing to do with the kid at all, directly, or the child interaction with the parent or something about the interaction together. The vast majority just focus on that. Very few treatments, a few but not that many, show generalization of effect
beyond that intimate interaction context. And even fewer, in fact, look at downstream. So this is an interesting pattern, and it shows that we've got to up our game in terms of longer term studies, basically. We've made progress, and there are some treatments that do show sustained effect now, but not mostly the most common ones used in practice. We then looked at the brain mechanism targets in a new generation of treatments. And here we get a lot of interesting leads, potential leads. So we've looked at, people have looked particularly at neurotransmitter function, at synaptic function, looked at cell signaling pathways, and neurotrophic factors, all of which have been implicated in the basic science of autism. And we review interventions that have targeted each of these different processes to see what shows sort of likely evidence of effect. And the bottom line of that work is that there are some useful leads from those neural mechanisms. None of them have yet been pushed into what we call phase three or bigger trials that could be then used in ordinary treatment. So there's nothing from that work of biological treatments that is actually applicable yet to health practice. But there are leads and there's progress being made. And there are a number of drugs that haven't worked. So the SSRIs are a good example that haven't worked for core autism symptoms. But there are a number of drugs that show promise, which we outline in the work. And of course, what we are after, and we tackle this in the paper, in the end of it, at least this is my personal view, is that we'll be looking at synergistic treatments. So we know that some treatments can actually produce long-term change in autism symptom severity and reduce that, which is the beginning of real treatment success, we think. We don't know yet what the limits to that psychosocial kind of treatment effectiveness might be, but it will have limits. And an obvious thing to do would be to add in synergistic brain chemistry targets so that we could have an additive effect. And that's what we hope. No one's shown that yet, but that's what we hope for the future. Finally, we say that there is a strong move towards a participation between clinical scientists, public, autism advocates, the autism community to co-construct outcomes in autism treatment research. So it's co-owned, so that we're addressing things that are scientifically important, but also important for parents and children.
Dr. Thank you. Brilliant summary. So, as I said before, please keep your questions coming. It would be great to have some questions from the audience. If you don't mind, I'd quite like to ask my own question.
Oh, go on, Ed. You are allowed to. Can I ask
No, I think it related a little bit to a question that somebody emailed in, but it was on a slightly different topic, so I didn't pose it before, but it seems very relevant, which is, what do you think you could identify some principles, and I'm inviting you to be a bit liberal here, moving not exclusively around where the evidence is potentially, about what are the principles that make intimate interventions stick? That means stick in terms of their long-term effects, but also stick as in generalise and have impacts beyond the immediate target. Do you think there are some principles there already that we could discern that would help us make interventions stick more effectively?
Well, it's a key question for the field. People who are familiar with autism as a condition will know that one of the characteristics is the difficulty that children with autism have in generalizing acquired skill across context. All children have to do that to generalize learning, and it's difficult for children with autism. So how do we do that in intervention? One way that we've personally, in our group and others as well, not just us, have tried to approach this is by saying, let's change the naturalistic environment around the child. So this is a home-based working with parents. Mm-hmm. If we can succeed in doing a social enhancement type intervention with parents, then theoretically we get a 24/7 treatment effect, which would continue ideally after the end of treatment. If the parents have really taken it on, then that the effect would carry on. So that would be one mechanism for a sustained effect.
Schools or the peer group?
Schools is another kind of environmental context in which we could also in parallel work, and we don't report that in the paper in this JCPP because there isn't any very strong evidence out, but there is work going on in schools. Mm. And indeed, that is another sort of parallel school-based intervention as well as home would be great. So you work both in those different contexts simultaneously to try and help the generalisation. Whether we could embed some neurophysiological, neurobiological change in children with autism that would help their ongoing development through these interventions is a key question. And the mechanism by which some treatments have shown sustained effects hasn't completely been worked out yet, but it may involve some neurophysiological, neurobiological change.
Great. So I do have a question from the audience, if that's okay. By the way, if you can mention your name, that's very nice. We get the sense of who you might be and where you're from. Yeah. This one's sort of posted anonymously, I think. If you haven't registered your name, it just doesn't record it. But yeah, the question is, in what way can information and research be successfully disseminated to counter misconceptions around autism spectrum disorders as a disease as opposed to a condition to the wider population? And I guess perhaps adding to that, you know, what does intervention tell us about that question?
This is a multifaceted question, I suppose. It's how we communicate our science and the work we do in the clinical science world into both practitioner practice. That's what we call implementation science. How do we get things implemented? And also just to the public consciousness and public education. And there are multiple routes of doing that. This kind of forum is, one kind of example. That's why I'm doing it. And we're particularly lucky, I think, in the UK. We do have some standard-setting bodies. Like the NICE committee and other standard setting bodies of that kind, so-called IAPT, curriculum development, which is supposed to give practitioners guidance of what is the best evidence-based practice and how to implement it. And even though we do at the moment have, an increasingly fragmented healthcare system in this country, unfortunately, nevertheless, I think that standard setting work still has effect in the UK. I think we're extremely fortunate in that, and we should be very proud of that. So we've got that kind of mechanism. I just think we have to go out as much as we can and talk about the work, blog about it, discuss it, whatever we can do, to talk about it in the public sphere, because we're all aware these days that there are multiple modes of communication. There's the blogosphere, the Twittersphere, the internet, as well as scientific bodies. And, you know, somehow we have to engage all of that with the best practice and the excitement of what we can achieve, mm-hmm.
Thank you. I think we've got time probably just for one very short question.
I was wondering, in terms of principles, one of the principles, Jonathan, be to take account of heterogeneity in autism. That is, try and develop treatments that target the specific pattern of pathophysiology. You know, the particular individual is showing the particular profile of deficits.
Yeah.
Would that be important?
It would be, and autism, like many the conditions that we deal with in child mental health, is highly heterogeneous. On the whole, the data at the moment haven't been very successful at finding, subgroup effects that could allow us to individualise or personalise treatment. Mm. I think there are two ways that which we can approach this better. One is by just being more ambitious in the size of the work that we do. And this is going to involve collaboration between people like me doing clinical science trials and other colleagues to get bigger sample sizes. Mm. Because it's only when you can power up these bigger sizes that you can really account for heterogeneity in your analysis. And most, as I said at the beginning, most treatment trials in autism to date have been woefully underpowered and small, too small. So that's one way. The other way of personalising would be to understand underlying mechanism better and targeting it. So part of the hope of the neuroscience focused treatments that I discussed is that we may be able to find some final common pathways that differentiate between different kinds of autism, perhaps. I have to say that hasn't happened yet. Mm. We're still searching for that, but it's possible in principle that we could find a way to personalise and individualise treatments.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, so last but not least, a great pleasure to introduce Ted Barker from the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, who we've sort of gone in reverse order here, because in the annual research review, we began with Ted's paper. It was very, very much from molecules up to kind of much bigger picture psychosocial sort of perspective. So we're doing this in reverse, and we're zooming in on the molecular mechanisms involved in psychopathology, which I think both of the papers that we've heard discussed already are hinting so strongly at that. And so the question that Ted was asking is, how do we understand how psychosocial exposures get under the skin in terms of molecular mechanisms and epigenetics? So, Ted, over to you.
Okay, well, thanks for the opportunity to be here, Edmund Pascoe, and I also want to, before I begin, thank my close collaborators, the co-authors, Charlotte Cecil and Esther Walton, without whom this review piece wouldn't exist. So the background of the piece is that it's quite clear that early adversity can have long-term impacts on mental health, and research has even pinpointed so-called sensitive and critical periods, prenatally, postnatally, but the biological mechanisms underlying these long-term effects aren't clear. And in recent years, DNA methylation, which is an epigenetic process that can influence gene expression, has emerged as a potential mechanism through which the genome can capture the effects of the environment and propagate them thereafter. And this idea of capturing and propagating is, in essence, a mediational framework. So the question is, does the environment impact the functioning of our genome via epigenetics, which then in turn increase vulnerability for a psychiatric disorder? And over the past decade, there's been a growing number of studies published, and a lot of these publications have focused on adult samples, and they've been cross-sectional with regard to DNA methylation. So ongoing longitudinal cohorts that collect DNA later on and then retrospectively follow back on data that's already been collected and ask, how does that impact the epigenome? And the smaller amount of studies have actually been focused on children. There's quite few, and actually longitudinal studies that you need to test mediational hypotheses are the smallest amount of publications. So the aims in review of the review piece that we did was that we were interested in sort of examining studies that looked at peripheral tissue. So we were interested in studies that were looking at living children or adults that had exposed to sort of traumatic experiences or adversity during childhood and were still alive. So there is no postmortem brain analyses in this. And we broke it down into adversity exposures, any studies that looked at those. Psychopathology studies, so we were looking at internalizing problems, depression, anxiety, externalizing problems too, which would be conduct disorder, ADHD, or ODD. We steered clear of autism. And then lastly, sort of integrative studies that put it all together to test mediation. And then lastly, what does it all mean? So summary of key findings, we in the adversity exposures, we identified quite a few studies that had we focused on risks that had been previously associated with child internalizing or externalizing problems. And we did indeed find quite a few studies that have reported DNA methylation associations with environmental variables such as dietary environment, neurotoxic exposure, so smoking is a big one, and then also stress exposures. There were very few studies that examined genetic influence, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about later. And also there tended to be very small samples and not very many longitudinal ones. So as one might guess, the most common were candidate gene studies that looked at the glucocorticoid receptor, right? Based on the Weaver et al. Sort of studies. And I don't really have time to get into why that's important. And then what's kind of interesting also is that there have been quite a few epigenome-wide association studies that look at adversity and how that relates to DNA methylation across the genome. No hypotheses, no candidate genes. And the glucocorticoid receptor doesn't often come up in these. Mm. So there's a discordant in sort of results. But equally interesting, in the EWAS studies themselves, so epigenome-wide association studies, probably the most extensively replicated one has to do with prenatal smoking, so that comes up time and time again. So then moving now to psychopathology-focused studies, we found studies that found DNA methylation associations with internalizing and externalizing. Again, quite a few candidate gene-focused studies, especially on the glucocorticoid receptor, very small, often didn't look at genetic influence, cross-sectional in nature. There were a couple prospective ones, and those came from Esther, Charlotte, and myself using the Avon longitudinal study, Parents and Children, in collaboration with Jonathan Mill and Carolyn Relton. And so Esther had one that was published in Molecular Psychiatry that was on ADHD. And she actually replicated one hit that was found in the highest powered GWAS on ADHD so far. Now, turning to mediational studies, there wasn't many, because I had talked about one of the big limitations is a lot of prospective studies didn't have the foresight to collect DNA methylation prospectively, and ALSPAC did, and that's Gene Golding had the foresight to do this. So in ALSPAC, there's DNA available at birth, 7, and then again at ages 15 to 20. So that allows you to sort of take a look at how the environment and the DNA interact. And so Charlotte did a mediational study on substance use, and that's in translational psychiatry. And she found that prenatal maternal smoking related to children's own substance use in adolescence via this epigenome-wide approach that she used. So it was centered around cord blood at birth. So basically, all studies that I've mentioned, including our own, are correlational, small samples. So what does it mean? So there's a few key methodological challenges in the field. The first is better characterizing environmental effects. So risks happen together, they're correlated. A lot of studies tend to look at one risk on its own, right? And the question of whether or not this is ecologically valid, I think, is an important one, because risks may not impact us singularly. We use depression and nutrition as an example that what you eat impacts how you feel, and how you feel impacts what you eat, and it can all impact your biology through varying sources. Second is needing to know more in general about the methylome, so normative development. What does it look like? Does it vary by ethnicity and cultural influence? And then also, like genome-wide association studies, DNA methylation studies need greater understanding of the functional relevance of the probes that are identified. So this is like in vivo experimental follow-ups. There's a great paper by Klengel et al. Out of Elizabeth Binder's group about FKBP5, where they really did a fantastic job. And then there's also scope, and that's that the sole function of DNA methylation is not expression. Not only expression, there's intermediate stages, and Jonathan Mills done a lot of research that intermediate stages can affect brain development and also can have dynamic changes to the landscape of DNA sequences themselves. So three outstanding challenges is what I'm going to end on. So the first one is know your tissue, right? So if you're interested in looking at living children, what can blood tell you? And it's a peripheral sample, and you can say, well, I'm interested in a biomarker, and a biomarker doesn't have to be causally involved, but there are specific criteria to achieve biomarker status. And in the case of blood-based biomarkers, it hasn't been easy so far to find biomarkers for brain-based mental health problems like depression, right? So is blood useful? There's growing evidence that peripheral inflammatory markers can affect brain function, so they might be, you know. Is it a surrogate of central nervous system functioning? I don't think that's known right now, but that leads to the second of the three, which is understand genetic influence. So studies that can tell you a little bit about the relationship between blood and brain are those that look at cross-tissue expression of DNA methylation. And there's just this really interesting paper published by Lin et al., I think, in Genome Biology, that basically found, using newer technology, that there is higher cross-tissue expression of genetically influenced DNA methylation than previously before thought. And what's interesting about this study is they found the cross-tissue expression was significantly enriched in genetic risk loci for various diseases, especially schizophrenia. So knowing your genetic influence is probably very important if you want to look at environmental effects. And then the last one is strengthening causal influence. And here I'm going to talk a little bit about reverse causality. So that DNA methylation, it may arise secondary to the development of mental health problems. It may not be a predictor of. And equally likely is that it could be a marker of mental health associated environmental exposures. So people who have mental health problems may have different environmental exposures. And there's a wonderful paper that's just recently been published by Sarah Marzi using eRisk in American Journal of Psychiatry, where they looked at victimization from childhood to adolescence, and they had DNA methylation at age 18. And they sort of followed back, what does the DNA methylation tell you about those prior experiences? And they used epigenome-wide approaches in addition to candidate gene approaches. And one interesting finding is some of their top loci were those that have already been identified in smoking. And so when they controlled for smoking, all of the significant hints were no longer significant. So the question is, if we could change victimization experiences, would that result in change in DNA methylation in these loci? Or could it be that if you change victimization experience, it would change health-related behaviors, which then would change methylation in the loci? And the very important sort of questions, but to answer those questions, you need repeated measures of everything all the way through.
Including the blood.
Yeah, including the blood. And,
yeah, great. Thanks. You have a question? Okay. Yeah. Please go for it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm a little bit mindful of time, but I think we're doing okay.
Just
but, and we have one question at least from our audience, so it would be great to get that in as well.
But go for it, Gordon. Just picking up the themes of the three presentations, and thank you for that presentation. I'm struck by a question I was asked by a practitioner recently around the field of epigenetics. And this practitioner was specifically the area of adoption and foster care. And I reviewed the work by Michael Meaney, which I know you will have mentioned in your paper, which is an animal study, cross-fostering study, where frequency of licking between high-nurturing and no-nurturing mums was associated with DNA methylation and cross-generational patterns of licking in that sample, which raises the question, if licking as an environmental index is associated with DNA methylation and gene expression, at what point does that process become inaccessible? So the core question was, how late is it, or is it ever too late to intervene? So if we take, again, the autism domain and move away from just discrete definition of autism to more dimensional definition of autism, my work around exposures, not just presence or absence of domestic violence or divorce, et cetera, mental health problems being multiple, and then the processes, I guess the question is, is it too late to intervene? I've always said that early intervention is early intervention in the life of a problem, not early intervention in life. So depression, for example, being an adolescent domain, autism, again, by having a kind of dimensional and sort of trajectory-based profile. And DNA methylation epigenetics, at what point do those systems become ineligible to change? I think that's a key factor for us in terms of intervention science.
I think that's a great question, and I don't think there's an answer to it. You know, that I think immediately of sort of James Heckman and his idea of early intervention having a far greater reward return in the long run. But also Tom O'Connor, I think, a little while ago wrote a review piece in JCPP, I think, where he had talked about this idea of early intervention, but there to date were no intervention studies that compared the efficacy of early intervention versus late. So I don't know that it is known. And those studies by Meaney et al., I think, are very important. But I don't think that there's the scope in research design yet to be able to answer that question in humans.
But we should be asking the question.
We should be asking the question. Yeah,
we should. Yeah. I mean, it has crucial, obviously, policy implications. So early intervention is, you know, a rhetoric that's often used, and it is pretty evidence-free. And it has a lot of bearing on what services are produced when and everything else. So, yeah, I just echo that this is something that we really need to study. Insofar as autism goes, I think we have evidence that very early and later can be helpful, actually. Yeah. I don't think there's any either
or. It's never too late to intervene.
I'm going to slightly sort of leap in here just because I want to get this last question in, and we're really running out of time. But I want to ask it partly because I know Ted's going to really enjoy the question, which is again, anonymously, actually. But This is about understanding adversity outside of Western relatively well-resourced contexts. Mm-hmm. And so what do you think is the potential here for understanding adversity in other parts of the world where there's much less by way of resources?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really important question, and probably one that some people may be asking in this. There's some global mental health calls out right now, and I would think that there would probably be much, if it is true the epigenome is responsive to environmental conditions and we have low and middle income countries have much higher types of adversity and different types of exposures, you know, like violence, trauma in Africa is going to be very different than what we experience here in the UK. That's a very important question. One hopefully someone will be looking at very soon.
Watch this space.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. I'm afraid we're really out of time.
Obviously. Yeah. So, but thank you very much to everybody. That's an absolutely wonderful discussion. I really hope it's whetted your appetite for the special issue, and I hope that you do contact us in terms of on the Twitter accounts and through email and so forth, and keep involved with the association and with the journal. Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.